Resource Committee will come to order. Since none of the members of the Oil and Gas Committee are here yet, we'll take up the two bills that we as Resources Committee have on our calendar for today. Is Tally here now?
Yep, she's moving.
Okay, we'll take up the other one, get her up here.
We understand the bill.
The first bill before us is SB 449, which is authorizing the Healy Project. We went through that yesterday. If you have questions, would you like to hear further testimony?
I would move that we put it out with individual recommendation. We even know what it is. Ask consent.
Is there objection?
One.
So be it. On SJR 80, Senate resolution, I think you're very familiar with. We do need Tally from Senator Pierce's staff, since there are some changes that need to be made in this legislation. We have also, while she's getting here, some people who'd like to testify. We'll bring up, please, Jim Butler, the mayor, from the mayor's office in Kenai.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jim Butler, and I work as a special assistant to Mayor Don Gilman, Kenai Peninsula Borough. Since the grounding of the Exxon Valdez nearly a year ago, the Kenai Peninsula Borough has been actively involved in responding to and dealing with the impacts of oil on the communities of the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Because of the many issues that surfaced as a result of this bill, Mayor Gilman brought me on board as staff. For the past year, I've coordinated the borough's activities associated with the ongoing response effort. I've also begun to work closely with the local oil industry in Cook Inlet, along with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, to look for new ways to prevent and respond more effectively to oil spills in Cook Inlet. Previously, I worked as a U.S. Senate staffer in Washington, D.C. in transportation, fisheries, and commerce issues. During my staff work in Washington, D.C., I continued to return home and work in the local Kenai Congressional Office, as well as commercial fish. My background in Cook Inlet includes 12 years as commercial salmon and halibut fisherman, and the past 7 years, I've run my own fishing boat. I've also participated in the 1987 Glacier Bay oil spill incident, acting as a federal liaison for the Alaska delegation. Today, I'd like to address your subcommittee, or your committee, on SJR 80, a resolution encouraging the American Petroleum Institute, Petroleum Industry Response Organization, to locate oil spill response equipment in Alaska. As you are probably aware, after the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, it became painfully obvious that a lack of oil spill response equipment in Alaska contributed significantly to the delayed mobilization of an adequate oil control, containment, and recovery effort. Many familiar with Cook Inlet also remember the same frustration of equipment shortages from the 1987 response to the Glacier Bay oil spill in Cook Inlet. While it is clear that the Alaskan oil industry should be better prepared to respond to medium and large-sized oil spills in Alaska, and in fact, they are becoming better prepared today, the cost associated with initial capitalization of large inventories of equipment, which are likely to be used very seldomly, often run so high, many operators simply cannot afford it. Initial attack oil spill equipment may be available in the area of a spill, but if the spill is larger than local resources can handle, valuable time is wasted while equipment is mobilized from the lower 48 to help the cleanup effort. All the variables of the logistical equation of moving big equipment far distances must add up just right, or you end up with a tragically slow response and a far greater likelihood of major environmental impact. The American oil industry has recognized the need to pool the cost of acquiring and holding major oil spill response equipment in regional centers so it might be readily available to local response corps that are faced with a spill that overtaxed their local response capabilities. With the lessons of the Exxon Valdez fresh in the collective national industry mind, the API has begun to explore how, through the Petroleum Industry Response Organization, or PIRO, the oil industry might develop equipment caches with response experts in regional centers around the nation. Unfortunately, Alaska has not been identified at this point as a location for such a response center. While the API and PIRO have made great strides in developing a concept that addresses acquiring and holding regional inventories of major oil spill response equipment, while using many of the lessons learned from the Exxon Valdez spill to support their positions, it seems rather short-sighted to exclude Alaska from their plan. Given the role Alaska plays in the production and transportation of a large part of the nation's oil, and the likelihood of major oil spills in remote locations associated with this activity, the Kenai Peninsula Borough agrees that a closer examination of the needs of the Alaska oil production region is in order. The Kenai Peninsula Borough has felt the impacts of oil spills on its environment and its economy in two of the last 3 years, and we continue to experience impacts of the most recent spill. We know too well that all too often valuable time is lost during the critical first few hours and days of an oil spill searching for more equipment as local initial attack equipment is overtaxed. We recognize that much of Cook Inlet Field is in decline and facing narrowing operating margins. We also recognize that more and more fields in Alaska are in fact in decline, and that it is these marginal fields that will continue to employ Alaskans and contribute significantly to our economic base. A centralized inventory of large spill equipment that can be mobilized throughout the state when needed will help industry better afford the cost of higher levels of oil spill response preparedness and hopefully keep them economically viable and employing Alaskans longer. More importantly, the citizens and communities that face the highest risk of environmental and economic impact in the areas of potential oil spills will benefit if response equipment can be rapidly deployed from an Alaskan-based location. With the still developing local response corps integrated with regional response plans, Alaska should be able to provide a system that can effectively utilize a central major oil spill equipment cache. Alaskans should not have to wait for equipment from the West Coast to be mobilized to Alaska by suppliers unfamiliar with Alaska's unique logistical challenges. On behalf of the Kenai Peninsula Borough, I'd like to thank your committee for considering SJRE and would encourage you to support it. This positive statement from the Alaska State Legislature will send a clear message to the nation's oil spill planners. With the nation's most promising prospects for future oil development and exploration in Alaska, the state of Alaska and its citizens will continue to bear the frontline risk of oil spills. By encouraging the API and Puro to take a closer look at Alaska's contribution to the nation's oil consumption and the role Alaska could play in the Puro strategy, we believe you are doing a service not only for the citizens of the Kenai Peninsula Borough, but for the citizens of the state of Alaska as well.
Are there questions, members?
That's a statement.
A statement, sir? Go right ahead.
One, I totally agree with them. Two, I find that representing the upper end of the Kenai Peninsula, that the industry there was having and may continue to have problems getting tankerage of oil into the area because there's an argument on who is responsible for the accidents, recovery, and so on. Who's liable? The receiver, the recipient, the purchaser, the tanker, we need this response here in order to continue to get oil up there for those refineries. We need this response. I don't want this happening back in Washington, but it's become a really significant problem for those people who wish to purchase oil up there to refine. I've run into it all winter long.
Would you please look as a committee on there's been an error in the way the bill is written on the bottom line, page 929, resource should read response. And on the next page, line 8, resource should read response. I'll bring that to your attention now.
I'd move those changes if you wish a motion.
Is there objection? Those corrections will be made. I consider that technical and not requiring a substitute, so we'll.
You wish a motion on the bill?
We have one more test passer. Are there other questions? Did you have questions, Senator Lusk?
No, I'm just reiterating.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim Robinson from the Regional Citizens Advisory Committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Tim Robertson. I represent the Regional Citizens Advisory Committee that was formed for Prince William Sound after the spill last year. I'm Vice President for Oil Spill Response and Prevention on that committee, and I also represent the City of Soldotna on the committee. I'd like to speak in favor of this resolution because I've looked at Alyeska, and the committee's met over 20 days now looking and talking about their sea plan and what they plan to do after in the event of another spill. And they don't have any intentions of putting any equipment outside of Prince William Sound at all. So last year when the oil spill came to Soldotna and all the equipment in the world was headed to Prince William Sound, we had to go out and dig out of the back of our backyards, lumber and tarps and things like that. And we make boom out of what was available there because there was no equipment available to communities away from the spill. And we ended up feeling pretty bitter about it. I think that the industry as a whole has to take some responsibility for oil transportation outside of the sound. Alyeska is putting a lot of equipment and manpower in there now and putting their attention where they need to. We as a state need to help support the whole region, the whole broad region. So we need more equipment and it needs to be located along the coast where there's some access to it. If a tanker ran aground in Lower Cook Inlet near my home today, there was no response anywhere within about 12 hours. a lot of oil can leak out onto the water in 12 hours. And so I would recommend that we bring this kind of equipment into state and that we would disperse it so that it's close to the whole transportation corridor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim. Are there questions, members of the committee?
Well, Chairperson, it's the same thing as the military. Washington, D.C. is closer to providing support for the installations in West Germany than it ever was to coastal Alaska, although we're 2 miles across in some places. We just get ignored, and we're getting ignored here. I think that this is the minimum we could do. We'll do a lot more.
There's no question in my mind, if we have that response equipment here, we'll never have a spill.
That's right. That's right. That'd be the fee.
That's the only ones I have signed up to testify. Close the committee. What is your pleasure?
I move and ask unanimous consent to the resolution to put out with conditional recommendation.
With the resource change to response.
Yes, the resource change.
Are there objections? So be it. Thank you very much.
All right.
I have a bill up in another committee. Can you take it over for just a minute?
Yep.
I'll be right there. And
we're ready for the hearing.
Like calling Larry.
Larry Dietrich. Presentation oil spill legislation. You may have the floor. And please introduce yourself for the record. Proceed.
My name is Larry Dietrich. I'm with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. I did bring some overheads today to try to show you all the pieces of the administration's oil spill package and would proceed to show that to you if that's your pleasure.
Please proceed.
Could you give me some guidance on how much time so I can...
You have about 30 minutes.
Okay.
That long? Come back Monday.
It's all right, Chair. I'll sit over here.
Yes, please. Okay. Please just proceed. We expected the Oil and Gas Committee to be here too. I don't know what's happened, but please proceed. Every one of us have other committee meetings to attend. So.
Thank you. Yes, what I'll try to do is try to break out. There's a number of bills dealing with proposed changes in the oil spill legislation, and I'll try to break this out and show you some history of how oil spill legislation has evolved in the state and how the planning efforts and the response efforts all fit together. We usually look at an oil spill program as having three basic parts: a prevention, preparedness, and response. The administration's goal has been to focus on prevention of spills and to take steps to ensure that the industry has an adequate response capability and to also take steps to ensure that the government response in a catastrophic event is enhanced. So I will work through these and try to finish this in the time frame here. The prevention part of the program, what does prevention typically include? A lot of the things included in a prevention program for an oil spill program are in the federal arena. They include such things as vessel traffic systems, tanker design and construction, manning standards, improved radar, pilots, substance abuse testing, vessel escorts, weather restrictions. The other things that are normally cataloged as preventative in nature are liability ceilings and penalties that provide incentives for preventing spills from occurring. Again, most of the navigation and tanker design things are in the federal arena. There is a federal oil spill bill working its way through now. The state has been actively lobbying on the preemption issue in that bill and has also supported the double hull initiative. This is how the laws that pertain to prevention look like. If you will, there's basically been the biggest chunk of legislation that has come online for oil spills occurred, it was actually started in 1976 with right before oil in the TAPS pipeline. What happened after that, there were some court challenges. There were some things that fell out of those bills, and the legislation that was finally put on the books in the state of Alaska basically came on in the 1981 timeframe. That's why we've cataloged all of this as things that were on the books prior to 89. Just to briefly highlight these, oil pollution was prohibited, ballast water discharges were prohibited, the first criminal penalties went on the books. The dollar per gallon rates that you're probably aware of are also known as the civil penalties for discharge of oil. Originally came on the books then. There was an 18,000 gallon exemption. The amounts per gallon, depending on the receiving environment, ranged up to $10 per gallon, and the penalty could be multiplied by 5 if negligence was involved in the spill. The liability limit that originally was put on in the state was up $100 million. There's a strict liability provision. There's provisions for recovery of costs to the state, detention of vessels, the security for damages, and general powers for emergency powers and injunctive powers were on the books. In 1989, after the big spill in Valdez, the next pieces of legislation came on, and basically what happened last year was a special section was installed, civil penalties for crude spills. The 18,000 gallon threshold was kept. A dollar amount for crude spills, $8 for the first 420,000 gallons spilled was placed on the books, and $12.50 gallon per month in excess of that. There was a 4x multiplier for negligence. There is a credit applied for the amount of oil recovered in the first 36 hours, and the liability limit was up to $500 million, a significant change from the $100 million that was on the books prior to that. Proposed changes this year include strengthening the financial responsibility requirements, strengthening the penalties to provide incentives to avoid spills, and to undertake contingency planning. On the preparedness side, there are several things that usually constitute preparedness for a spill. On the industry side, it includes contingency planning, and in this state, the initial requirement for contingency plans for oil terminal facilities, tankers, and barges came into being in 1981. There's a requirement for financial responsibilities. We have training, drills, and inspections, all components of industry preparedness for a spill. On the government side, you also have contingency planning. There are some new provisions related to that I'll get into with the State Emergency Response Commission, with state, regional, and local contingency planning. The other things that are happening include response funding, response depots, volunteer corps, spill technology research, and drills. These are the laws then pertaining to preparedness. Again, going back to prior to 1989, the contingency plan requirement originally on the books for oil terminal facilities applied to all terminals with 10,000 barrel storage or greater. It also includes offshore exploration or production facilities, tank vessels, and oil barges. We do have a requirement for proof of financial responsibility. There is a provision for inspection authority. We have the authority to enter into interstate compacts for spill prevention, containment, and cleanup. The department also has general contracting authority for oil spill cleanup, and there's a provision that was placed on the books in 81 whereby the Department of Environmental Conservation would perform the role of the Division of Emergency Services and declare disaster emergencies for oil spills. Again, after the Exxon Valdez, the new laws that went on the books last year included a provision in SB 261 for development of a state master oil and hazardous substance discharge and prevention contingency plan. It's essentially a statewide government response plan. It also provided for development of regional plans. The planning on both of these is underway now. There's a provision for us to conduct unannounced spill drills. There is another provision to begin developing some spill technology capability and expertise within the state. And there's a provision for response corps training. Proposed changes for preparedness for 1990 include unlimited use of the response fund during a declared disaster emergency. This is a change from how the fund can be used right now. It was a point of concern for many of the communities that were impacted by the spill. There's also a provision here which would expand the role of the Division of Emergency Services in catastrophic spills. It would essentially return their normal role to them instead of us performing it as is required under current law. There's a provision to establish the State Emergency Response Commission and local emergency planning districts. This would be the basic building blocks of a coordinated state response capability. It would extend the requirement for contingency plans to additional facilities. Primarily, it would drop the threshold for contingency plans from 10,000 barrels to 5,000 barrels. And there's a provision to strengthen the state's inspection authority to include structural integrity inspections of tank vessels. to get into the State Emergency Response Commission and what that's all about, real briefly, the State Emergency Response Commission that's in the proposed legislation would formalize a process for developing response plans at the local level. The two things that the State Emergency Response Commission would do would be to develop the state and regional plans that were required by the legislation passed last year, and would implement the Federal Emergency Planning Community Right to Know Act under federal CERA Title III. At the local level, the local emergency planning committees, which are set up and sanctioned by the State Emergency Response Commission, their primary mission then is to develop local emergency response plans and to have spill response preparedness at the local level. That basically involves drilling and training. How does this planning effort fit together? This is how it looks. Again, the State Emergency Response Commission would provide the oversight to develop the state master plan and the regional master plans. The state plan would be a statewide plan that would be comprised of regional plans developed within the state. Each regional plan then would be made up of local emergency response plans that are developed through the local emergency planning committees. Each of these committees then are established to provide a response plan that can be as sophisticated as a community wants or as simple as a community wants. The two examples that we've been using include maybe a place like Chignik, which may just want to have a local response plan that consists of one boat, one bucket, and maybe a rake, or it may be something along the lines that the Kenai Borough is exploring, which has a government industry co-op. The advantages of local emergency planning units is that there's an existing structure. If we have a local emergency response plans that's integrated into the state, regional, and master plans, we will have an integrated response capability then that can be mobilized at the time of any significant spill. The local planning committees provides maximum flexibility. It can be made up primarily of industry. It can be industry and government, special interest groups, whoever they determine at the local level wants to participate. This also provides an avenue for technical assistance, training, and funding that we can provide to local communities. The structure is already established, and this mechanism would provide a coordinated planning at both the state and local level. There are four local committees that are sanctioned already. They include the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the Kenai Peninsula Borough, the Kodiak Island Borough, and the City of Yakutat. The Fairbanks North Star Borough has already developed a plan. It's being reviewed by the Response Commission now. There are 10 other local governments from Bethel all the way to Sitka that have applied for local planning authority, and there are 16 other jurisdictions that have expressed an interest. What do the regional boundaries look like? Here are the proposed regional boundaries for the regional plans that are under consideration right now. Each one of these would be made up then of smaller local response plans. Our priority regions are Cook Inlet, we feel, is number one because that's a major marine transportation area for crude. Prince William Sound, of course, the capabilities being enhanced there. Southeast would be a separate planning region. And then you have these others as shown here. Here's an example of, this looks kind of a busy chart, but there's a lot of work going on in the Kenai right now to develop an industry government response plan. I'll just be brief about this. This is really state-of-the-art response capability. There's a lot of innovative thinking going on down there right now to try to get the government and industry together to get a single response capability.
Something like this going on in Texas now.
This was, sir, modeled after the Corpus Christi. I believe a number of the companies and the Kenai Borough people have been down there and looked at that model in the development of their own. Yeah. Quickly, what it provides for is member companies, shippers, producers, and terminals and possibly other parties who would all chip into a kitty, which would be, in this case, it's labeled the Cook Inlet Spill Control and Response, Inc. It would have a board of directors. This organization then would provide a response capability for all of its members in Cook Inlet. So it would be an actual response organization. They're working on income sources to make this viable. Again, membership fees, possible funding from the 470 account, local governments, cost recovery from the spiller are all our revenue streams that they're looking at to make this a go. In addition, as you just heard, an attempt to get the payroll organization to participate. It does include a response organization, so they would have capability when an event occurred to actually go out to respond, contain, and clean up the spill. If this is successful, I'm sure it's will be unique in this state and will be a good model to follow. The last category then is in the response arena. Response includes notification, containment, exclusionary booming, cleanup, disposal, damage assessment, restoration, and finally cost recovery. Here's the batch of laws dealing with response activities once an event has occurred. Again, there's a mandatory spill reporting requirement in the state of Alaska. There's provision for containment and cleanup of discharges of unknown origin by the department. Existing authority requires maximum practical use of private services and resources. There's a provision to ensure that cleanup is initiated and adequate. And a provision on the books to identify the source, cause, and responsible party of all spills. Last year, legislation was passed that created the response office, and this was intended for catastrophic spills or spills that presented a grave and substantial threat. So it's the bigger spills that the response office is intended for. It established a response corps, and it established a response depots to be created in those regional areas throughout the state. Proposed changes for this year include a definition for the realistic maximum oil discharge. This has been one of the more talked about provisions. It's the one that dictates the spill scenario the companies would have to design to. There's also a provision that requires implementation of contingency plans. So how does all of this come together then when a spill occurs? Typically, what happens right now, and in the state, when a spill occurs, you have an incident. The department is the state on-scene coordinator under both state and federal law. If it's in federal jurisdiction, that would be the federal on-scene coordinator, as it was down in Valdez. The Coast Guard has jurisdiction in most of the marine waters. We then are the coordinator for all the state's efforts and would work with the federal on-scene coordinator. The resources that are available to us now would include the response depots and the response corps that are under development. What happens when you get to a spill? The department normally initiates oversight. You identify the source and cause of the release. You identify the responsible party. Determine the nature, amount, and location. You classify the spill size, determine the direction and time of travel, assess the feasibility of removal, and judge whether or not the responsible party is adequately cleaning up. If you have an adequate responsible party and they are doing the job, the state doesn't do any cleanup. They simply do oversight. And as long as the party is continues to provide containment so that the spill is not spreading, no further action is taken. On the other hand, if there is no responsible party, then the state has to step in and start a cleanup. So in either event, when you either don't have a responsible party or when the responsible party is responding but it's exceeding, the spill is exceeding their capability, that's when the state starts to get involved in a spill. And at that point, we would bring in our oil spill contractors, which we have standing contracts for, and we would either work to augment the responsible party's cleanup or just take over the cleanup if there was no responsible party. What this planning exercise does is gives us the capability in a bigger event mobilized local resources that have been developed and have local response plans. If those resources are exceeded and you need more, then we would go to the regional plans and bring in the regional capability. If that was exceeded, then we would bring in the statewide resources. And it's at this level where you hit a declared disaster area for the state of Alaska. And certainly the maximum event, which I think we've just experienced, you bring in the Pacific Strike Team and the National Response Team to help out. How then do you direct the cleanup activities? Well, the incident command system, which you may have heard about, is the system that's being adopted for both the state and regional plans. The incident command system provides for an incident commander and cooperating agencies. There's basically four components to an incident command system. It includes a planning component, a logistics component, an operations, and a finance. Coast Guard uses this system. The existing state contingency plan is modeled after the ICS, and this is the response plan that we would propose to use for mobilization of state, regional, and local resources.
Same as clarified.
This is exactly the same. As a matter of fact, DNR and the firefighters are probably the experts of the incident command system in the state. They work pretty much the same way. They are the incident commander. The other agencies that may have jurisdiction participate in the decision making. Oil spills would be the same, virtually the same way. What you actually have here is our maximum organizational structure for the big event would look like this if we mobilize all our resources. I mean, a simple event for us is to send one person out and work directly with the responsible party and it gets cleaned up and it's over. A maximum event like the Exxon would be where you bring in a multitude of state agencies and federal agencies. The way you deal with that in the incident command system is they have what you call a unified command structure. The unified command structure is used in those events where you have multi-agency and multi-jurisdictions. The agency with the greatest jurisdiction or statutory authority acts as the incident commander. So in oil spills, that's either the Coast Guard or DEC. The agencies that have an involvement in the spill, a jurisdiction of one kind or another, then have agency reps that have the full decision-making capability of their organization. They participate in the unifying command, and they jointly set goals, objectives, and strategies. Again, on the forest fire model, a number of agencies are employed in that. There's a lot of resource decisions that have to be made in fighting forest fires. Whether you're going to use chemicals for suppression or water or back burn or whatever you're going to do. Oil spills are somewhat similar. There's a variety of decisions that have to be made with containment, cleanup, dispersants, burning, chemicals. Those decisions are made by the on-scene coordinator. The on-scene coordinator then taps the resources of the other agencies in making that decision, whether it's fish and game, natural resources, or if it's a declared, if it reaches the declared disaster level, whereby the Division of Emergency Services would be mobilized, then they would also participate. That pretty much, Madam Chair, is the overview. I think I try to keep it short here.
Other questions for members of the committee? Well, we very much appreciate it. I don't know what where the oil and gas members are. It's a joint session. We appreciate your coming in and trying to enlighten us. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
With that, anything come up? Any of you? The committee's adjourned.